Pound the Rock, the Scores NBA podcast. My name is Joseph Cacciaro, and I'm joined, as always, by co-host Joe Wolfhund.
What up, Cash? How you feeling this morning?
I'm all right, man. How are you feeling after our disgusting performance in the Raptors media open run at Scotiabank Arena?
Look, I was a little rusty. Hadn't touched a basketball since pre-COVID times, and it's not like I was any great shakes before then, but the rust was real. So, you know, I wrapped up a 0 point performance with some nice peripheral stats, I think.
Yeah, you had a big steal late in the game.
Made some hustle plays on defense, had a chase down block, and I felt good about that. Felt good about my effort, but yeah, it's just, it's such a feel oriented sport that if you haven't played for a while, like I was thinking about Pascal Siakam in the bubble. After he like didn't touch a basketball for 4 months during the COVID shutdown. And I mean, man, it doesn't come back right away. I will say that. But had a lot of fun, feeling kind of sore this morning, but excited to jump on here and talk to you about some actually good basketball players.
Pound the Rock, a combined 0-for in that game. I know you bricked a layup at the end, but it was nowhere near as bad as my young Kobe in Utah back-to-back air balls from deep.
Yes. And then, unfortunately, you do not have a bright and promising career ahead of you.
No.
Where you can look back and think about those air balls as like a stepping stone to greatness.
No, it's a stepping stone into retirement for me. Yeah.
A capstone to a not illustrious career.
Yeah.
Although, I don't know, we might have another showing coming up if we wind up playing in this 3-on-3 tournament for Raptors Republic, but
yeah, we try to redeem. The last time I touched a basketball was May 2022 for my shout out my guy Ron, who did his bachelor party at, like, we partied at night, but in the day he rented out a gym and we just played pickup ball, and it was like a tournament. That was the last time I touched a basketball. My team won that tournament. I hit the tournament winning shot, and my shot was on that day. And so I went into yesterday thinking, in terms of like good tangible basketball skills, don't have enough. But we're playing full court. I can get up and down the court. If I'm open, I'll take a shot. I got no problem with that. And the shot making did not carry over from 2 years ago and did not carry over onto an NBA size court. So,
And I'll say it didn't help for me that on like the second play of the game, Savannah Hamilton, the Raptors sideline reporter, who can really hoop,
who carried us.
I like entered her the ball in the post. She got double teamed and like whipped it back out to me, and I wasn't expecting it. Hit me in the face, knocked out one of my contact lenses, and so I was just playing from that point on with like zero depth perception. I'm not like, I got really bad eyesight, so that didn't help. I basically had one working eye for the rest of that game. Yeah. And that's why, I mean, I wound up taking a couple of shots, but I was generally, you know, trying to avoid having to do that. But, you know, there were a couple situations where you just need to keep the defense honest by letting them know that you're at least willing to pull the trigger.
Yeah, which I did. And the defense was quite happy about it. Last thing I'll mention, because I know people don't care too much about our performance in a media open run, but the funniest part of the day for me was, shout out Coach Jama Malalela, who is an assistant with the Raptors. The Raptors had two assistants take one of the media teams each. So we had Coach Jama. The other team had Coach Pat Delaney from the Raptors staff. For those who don't know, Jama Malalela has coached the Raptors, been an assistant coach with the Raptors in the past, is now again, was once the head coach of the Raptors G League team, the 905, and also spent a couple years in Golden State as an assistant, where he won a championship in 2022 with the Warriors. So Jama's been around, obviously, a great basketball mind to have that kind of resume and, you know, be an NBA assistant coach. And we very much appreciate him taking the time to coach some bums like us. But the funniest part of the day was Jama drew up a play like for each quarter for our team, basically. And we would just run that play all game, all quarter. But in one of the quarters, he drew up a double drag in which, for some reason, he made me the first screener. I don't know if maybe that was some sort of like sticking it to me. just to really drive home how unqualified I was for this. But no, on a serious note, appreciate the time from Pat Delaney and Jama Malalela. Appreciate the Raptors inviting us to the open run. And as much as we're joking about our performance, neither of our performances were anywhere near the worst. So on that note, let's get to some real NBA basketball. I guess before we get to the main part of our show, which is picking up where we left off last week and talking about the new faces and new places and how guys who got traded this season are doing in their new environments, do want to mention off the top, Brandon Ingram injured his knee last night, calling it a left knee contusion. He's out minimum 2 weeks. Not sure if you saw the play. It looked really scary in the moment. His leg buckled as he was defending a Jalen Suggs drive. He looked to be in a lot of pain. So obviously any injury sucks, but I would say given what it looked like last night, contusion, minimum 2 weeks, maybe not as bad as it looked. Any thoughts on the Pels without Ingram for at least the next couple of weeks? I mean, the playoffs start in 3 weeks. This is a team that's trying to hold on to a top six seed, a team that was playing at almost a 50-win pace, one of four teams top 10 on both ends. It would be a real shame if injuries once again derail the Pelicans, and it would be especially be a shame this season where, for the most part, they've stayed relatively healthy and have put themselves in the position they have.
Yeah, I mean, they looked for a minute like they were going to have a decent chance to run down the Clippers for four. This might make that a little bit more difficult. And yeah, they've got teams breathing down their neck even to stay in the top six. Now, we've talked about the Suns' schedule down the stretch and how they might be primed to have a bit of a slide. But the Pelicans' schedule the rest of the way isn't that much easier, I don't think, than Phoenix's. And there's only a 1.5 game gap there between New Orleans and Phoenix, who are currently in seventh. So that's tough. I'll just quickly pull up the Pelicans' next few games, because like they have a sort of murderous stretch on the horizon. So they're going into play Miami tonight on the second night of a back-to-back after getting stomped by the Magic. Then they get the Pistons, and then they're home for the Thunder, Bucks, Celtics, Suns, Magic all in a row. So that's a tough stretch to be without your second best player. The one thing I'd say is like the Pels are one of these teams where, because they thrive on depth and because the top end talent, while it is very strong, doesn't like it's not always so mutually complementary. I don't know that they will feel the impact of that absence as much as you would expect when a player of Ingram's magnitude goes out of the lineup. Like, I think they can still be very successful, you know, moving Trey Murphy into the starting lineup. And obviously, like, your depth takes a hit there. But I think, you know, like we've talked about how all season they have not been successful with all three of Zion, Ingram, and McCollum on the floor together. They've been better when those guys have been kind of split up into different combinations. And so I think they'll be fine. Like, I don't, if I had to bet, I think they still wind up hanging on to a top six seed.
Yeah, and I hope that if they do, or however they get to the playoffs, you know, Ingram is fine by then. Because like I said, it would just be a real shame if we leave this Pelican season kind of wondering what if, as we have before, except this time after they showed us the kind of team they could be for like three quarters of the season.
Yeah.
Real quick, I guess I lied, because there was one more thing I wanted to get to before we get to the main part of our show. And I just want your quick thoughts on it, because you're the one who brought it to my attention earlier this week. DeAndre Ayton saying that one of the reasons he got off to such a slow start in Portland, and, you know, because now he had picked it up and he was playing well recently, and he said, you know, people forget, I'll find the exact quote here, but he said early in the season, his body just wasn't his body. People forget the human difference of me adjusting to everything, obviously after a trade. Just being comfortable in waking up. I didn't have a bed for quite some time. I was on an air mattress just trying to figure this out. Wolfond, what's left to say about DeAndre Ayton, man? As you, I think you perfectly and succinctly put it in a text to me, just an unserious human.
I don't think I said that. I think I said that I don't know that there's been another player, or at least like a high-profile player, like number one overall pick, who has taken his NBA career less seriously. And I don't know if that's actually true, but I've been a kind of an Ayton defender, at least to a modest extent, compared to you, I guess, in some of these conversations. But like, man, I am sure that there is somebody who would be happy to, on your behalf, go out and buy a regular mattress that you can sleep. Like, you are a professional athlete, dude, making upwards of $30 million a year in a sport where literally, like, your physical state is everything. Like, that's all you have to give is what your body can do. And you are not treating it with a lot of respect by sleeping on an air mattress for months, apparently.
Dude, it's in a way not surprising in that it's Ayton that's found himself in this predicament. Like, I also get, you know, I'm sure for athletes of that size, obviously it's not as easy as just going to get like a standard mattress from wherever. Like, it's probably going to be maybe a custom mattress for their size, whatever. But at the same time, there are a lot of NBA players out there. There are a lot of giant athletes out there who figure it out. And as you said, we're sure that there is someone probably that works for the Blazers that would have taken care of this for him in no time had he made it a priority. And like, I completely get the idea, like, understand that sometimes people, media fans, whatever, can have unfair standards for pro athletes or kind of forget that they're human. But like, in this case, sorry, that doesn't apply. Forget, you know, multimillionaire athlete. If one of our coworkers who we know can at the very least, like, you know, has a full-time salary, can afford a friggin' mattress, wasn't pulling their weight. And then when we talked about it, it was like, well, you know, guys, I've been sleeping on an air mattress for 6 months because I just haven't got around to buying a regular mattress. I would tell that average Joe to get their shit together, let alone when a $30 million a year NBA player does it. So yeah, those are my thoughts on DeAndre Ayton. All right, you want to get to the meat of our show now?
Who has been playing way better yes. lately, by the way. He had a run of 1, 2, 3, 4. He had a run of 6 straight games with at least 20 points. And in some of those games, like some monster rebounding totals too. 19, 15, 19, 14, 15. So I guess he's right. But that just makes it all the more frustrating that he burned like 4 months of this season.
Yeah.
Because his body wasn't right. Because he was sleeping on literal air.
Yeah. And again, it comes down to straight like organization and laziness in his case. So got no time.
Yeah. I know I asked you this already, but do you think he had any sheets on that air mattress or was he just raw dogging it?
I'm convinced he had no sheets. It was just like a air mattress on a floor somewhere. Look, because if he's going to go out and buy sheets, then I'm sure he could have bought a mattress in that time. Like the fact that he never took the time to even bring an online order a mattress or go in and find one, whatever, makes me think he probably didn't take the time to go get sheets. That dude was raw dogging it on that air mattress. And the Blazers, well, I was going to say they paid the price, but I guess not really. They wanted to be bad anyway. So, yeah. All right. You want to move on to players that probably are getting good night's rest who were traded this season, find themselves in new environments, took the time to get mattresses anyway.
Please.
All right. So we talked about Terry Rozier and the Mavs duo of PJ Washington and Daniel Gafford last week. So let's get to the guys from our New Faces in New Places piece that we haven't touched on the pod yet. And I think there's no better place to start than Indiana, where Pascal Siakam was probably the best player traded this season. Yeah, pretty definitively the best player traded this season, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I just sort of like I think he's a considerably better player than OG Anunoby, but in terms of the particularities of their skill sets and how they might fit on good teams, contending teams, I think maybe you could quibble about which one of them has had a bigger impact, at least when they've played for the teams that traded for them. But yeah, in a vacuum, definitely the best player traded was Siakam. And I think he's been really good for the Pacers. I guess I would say, and what I wrote, is it's really unfortunate that we haven't gotten to see, I don't think, the full scope of how good his fit is there, because pretty much ever since he got there, Tyrese Halliburton the guy that he was brought in to compliment has either been on the shelf or has been physically compromised since coming back from that hamstring injury. And he's had moments, and they've had moments together where it's looked synergistic, but like, I don't think it's like a perfectly synergistic two-man fit anyway, but I think just in terms of like what it could mean for the overall team structure, I don't think we've really gotten to see the full picture because Halliburton has not been Halliburton, at least not the Halliburton that we saw in the first half of the season, not even close.
Yeah.
So that's a shame, but I think like just Siakam himself, I think he's shown pretty much everything that you would have wanted to see from him in that new environment, like definitely taking advantage of the more spacious situation, getting, you know, double teamed less often in the post. And as a result, I don't actually have the updated stats in front of me, but when I wrote that piece, he was averaging 1.31 points per possession on post-ups as a Pacer, which among 59 players who had at least 50 such possessions since the trade, in the post was number three in the league. So he's been devastating in that sense. And he's just given them this element that I don't think they really had before in terms of the kind of mid-range scoring element. So like another illustration of that is, again, this is at the time that I wrote the piece. He had attempted 47 more non-rim two-pointers than anyone else on the team since the deal. And he had hit 52% of them. So he's just like finding the sort of soft spots in the defense that are opening up because, I mean, A, like defenses are more willing to concede shots in that mid-range area, but the Pacers are such like a three-point and rim-oriented team that I think they force adjustments from defenses that open up even more of those shots for a mid-range assassin like Siakam. And then you also have his transition play, which I think just meshes perfectly with the Pacers' identity. Like his ability to grab and go, to lead the break, but also to be a cutter or a trailer on the break when Halliburton is pushing the pace. Like they've had a really nice interplay in the open floor. It's in the half court that I think it hasn't really connected. And this is like something I'm realizing, I think, in thinking about that pairing, in thinking about like we can talk about the Raptors guys, but like Quickly and Scottie Barnes, like their inability to kind of click and get on the same page. We're seeing, I think, a lot better synergy from Dame and Giannis in like the back half of the season, but obviously that took a while. These 1-4 partnerships, like when your two best players are like a 1 and a 4, it's, and this kind of goes back to what we talked about last week. This was about Luka and Kyrie, which is not exactly a 1 and a 4, but it's like a lot of times like power forwards, especially like these modern power forwards who are more wingy than big, like they're not the best or most enthusiastic screeners. And then you're also like, if you're trying to run two-man game, there's going to be a center on the floor as well. And that's going to make it a little bit more difficult for the four-man to roll. And we've seen that be problematic even when you have a spacing five in like Miles Turner and Brook Lopez. It's just, I think, a little bit more challenging to forge like a perfect two-man game with a 1 and a 4. And that's okay. Like that, again, like I've said this before, that does not have to preclude two stars working in complementary fashion and amplifying one another. It's just in two-man games specifically, I think that pairing is or can be kind of tough. And that is why when this trade happened, I posited that the Siakam Buddy Hield two-man game was going to be more effective than the Halliburton Siakam two-man game. And I think that was true until the Pacers went ahead and traded Buddy Hield at the deadline. And suddenly, in terms of like inverted pick and roll, a guy who was going to go screens, fly out, be a real three-point threat, Siakam lost that. And Halliburton can do that in spots, but that's not really what he's most comfortable doing. And ultimately, he's going to be best with the ball in his hand. So they're, I think, still figuring out the division of labor in the half court, how they can work best together and play off of each other. And I'm looking forward to seeing like how that develops in future seasons, assuming that the Pacers re-sign Siakam. So that's on the offensive side of the ball, and we can get into talking about the defense too, but what have you thought?
Yeah, no, I thought I've been really impressed with Pascal's ability to kind of complete and diversify the Pacers offense, make them more of a three-level team, do it really efficiently. And I've been impressed with his ability to do it as efficiently as he has, despite, as you mentioned, the pieces that were supposed to make this as great a fit as it was, not being there, either in the case of Hield being traded or in Haliburton just being a shell of himself because of, you know, what seems to be the lingering effects from the hamstring injury. I mean, I'm not sure that's the case, but I can't think of anything else. And Pascal has just kind of gone about his business, done it really efficiently anyway. And like I said, even though in terms of pure team efficiency, the Pacers have not been as good as they were early in the season, I still think they are a more complete offense with Pascal's in-between game than they were early in the year. I mean, whether that bears out in the playoffs or not depends on a lot of things, matchup included. Like, but I don't really think they could have asked for much more from Pascal on the offensive end. As you mentioned, the transition fit, his ability to grab and go fits them perfectly.
Just to close the loop on that conversation about him and Haliburton specifically, yeah. Pacers have a negative scoring margin with the two of them on court together, which is not what you want when you're talking about your two best players. That's kind of tough.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned like assuming they retain him. I think we were both on the same page that like the Pacers making this trade indicated to us and anyone paying attention, all right, well, they're obviously going to be willing to like max him out. Have you seen anything over the last couple months that like have give you any qualms about that, like giving Pascal a full 4 or 5 year max? Like, forget, here's the way I would approach it. Forget coming from the perspective of like they moved assets for him, whatever, even though they didn't move a lot for him, but like even if they had moved a lot for him, take that out of the equation, you know, and kind of like the sunk cost fallacy part of it, and just like from a straight, you're the Pacers, this is what your team looks like, Pascal Siakam is your own free agent, do you have any qualms about giving him a full 4 to 5 year max?
I would say I have some qualms, yeah. Like, and I don't think it'll wind up being 5 years. I think they'll, like, from everything that we have heard sort of behind the scenes, he was prepared to sign a 4 year max with the Raptors. Like, he would have signed for 4. Maybe that's different. Like, he really wanted to stay in Toronto, and I don't know if he's as married to Indiana, but I don't think there's going to be a 5 year max out there. I mean, there couldn't be, right? Because you need bird rights to offer that. So
it's only the Pacers, yeah.
So I think that they will get him on a 4 year max, and I think that's fine. I don't think it's going to be an amazing deal. It might not age particularly well, but I really do like his fit there. And I think it's going to look better and better with more time. And yeah, like the last couple of years might look kind of sketchy, but I think, you know, look, the Pacers have a chance to be a team that's like fighting for home court the next 2 years, right? Like the front end of that deal, I think, is going to pay off. And like we've said before, like we said when they made the trade, this is the only type of opportunity that a team like Indiana has to acquire a player of Pascal Siakam's caliber, you know, outside of the draft, which like they're not going to be drafting in the lottery for the next little while. Like, you get a co-star for Haliburton that makes sense, that fits your identity. And so in that sense, no, I don't have qualms. It's just, I do definitely see potential scenarios where the back end of that deal could look kind of rough.
Did you want to talk about the Pacers defense? Did you want me to move us to the next team?
No, I think it's worth noting, and I said at the time the trade happened, it's not like you bring in Pascal Siakam and voila, your defense is fixed. But they were 27th in defensive efficiency before Siakam debuted, and they're 15th since then. So their offense has not been nearly as explosive as it was early in the season, again, because Haliburton just hasn't been the same guy. But the fact that they're up to league average defensively since Pascal, you know, debuted for them, that's really encouraging. And I think, you know, you don't attribute that solely to Siakam. There's also the fact that they moved Nembhard into the starting lineup, moved Nesmith into the starting lineup. Now they're in a situation where, like, they have 4 average to above average defenders starting for them. So there's no excuse for them to be in the bottom 5 in defensive rating. But there's also the trade-off there, right? Like, part of that is you trade Buddy Hield, who is not a good defender, but he was a big part of their offense. And so you see some of the dip at the offensive end, and like you come up at the defensive end, and you wind up around the same place that you were in terms of overall team quality. So they have to figure out, I guess, how they can get their offense back to where it was without sacrificing too much at the defensive end. But I think Siakam kind of is the answer to that, because their offense with him in the mix should be a lot better if or when Haliburton returns to the player that he was. And I think you can see the way that Siakam has helped them at that end. Just a much bigger body than the types of bodies that they were throwing at big wing scorers before he got there. And also, you know, I think the first like month or so that he was there, his sort of like low man work was not particularly impressive. I think lately that's really started to change. Like, he's turned it on at that end and become much better as like a secondary rim protector and a guy who's making those backline rotations where they just have more insulation behind and around Miles Turner than they had before. So he's not an elite defender by any means at this stage of his career, but I think he has made a huge difference just by being a huge body who can move really well and is very smart defensively. So, you know, I think, again, you're not attributing that rise solely to him, but I think he's been a big part of it.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, if Tyrese Haliburton is healthy, with Pascal Siakam there, and with like any semblance of spacing around him, that should be an elite offense. Like, whether it's, you know, on pace to be the most efficient offense of all time every season, that's another matter, like it was early in the season, but it should be an elite offense. And so I think the way they've defended recently is the path to potential contention for this team in the future, in that if the offense is as good as it should be with Haliburton healthy and Siakam there now and any semblance of spacing, you don't need an elite defense, right? You just need to not be terrible on that end. Can you be league average-ish, which they're flirting with post-Siakam trade? And if they can do that and get Haliburton healthy and kind of get things ramped up again next season, I think that is the path to this team. You know, you mentioned fighting for home court the next couple of years, whatever the case may be. And that's the reason to be excited if you're a Pacers fan, among others. You want to talk some Knicks?
Sure.
A positive conversation, but also a bit of a heartbreaking one, because this Knicks team that, you know, I mentioned after the deadline, I thought at full strength, they might be the second best team in the East now. I thought they could make the East Finals. I called them the best Knicks team of the 21st century and the closest thing to a contender the Knicks have seen in more than two decades. Unfortunately, they haven't been full strength since the deadline, and so we haven't really got a chance to see that. In terms of OG Anunoby, we've talked about his fit in New York before, because obviously he was dealt a month and a half before the deadline. When he's been in the lineup, he's really been that type of like glue guy that excels in his role and ties everything together for a contender. Guards the opposing team's best players. Wasn't guarding up as much in New York, because that's not really Tibbs' style in terms of like putting OG on opposing centers the way he was being utilized in Toronto in those matchups, but still often guarding the opposing team's best players. But really efficient in like a tertiary role where he's making it rain from the corners. He was shooting almost, or is shooting 45% from the corners as a Knick. You know, gets to the rim when he bullies a mismatch or with a well-timed cut, is efficient there. You put it all together, like there's a reason the Knicks were 15-2 with OG in the lineup, because he really did kind of tie everything together perfectly on both ends. Unfortunately, you know, he missed 18 games with that elbow injury, comes back, plays three, it flares up again. Now he's missed a couple, not really sure what his status is going forward, on top of the fact that this Knicks team, you know, has been missing Mitchell Robinson, has missed Julius Randle. Jalen Brunson has played kind of through some things, has missed some time, but is mostly back and carrying them in the ways only Jalen Brunson can. Even if they get Randle back, even if Robinson makes a surprise return, like they need OG back, and being the OG that they traded for, right? The guy that was tying everything together the way he was when he first got there. Other than that, obviously they also traded for Bojan Bogdanovic and Alec Burks at the deadline. Now, in terms of Bojan, I don't really know how much to glean from his performance since they acquired him, because he hasn't really gotten to play with the Knicks team he was supposed to play with and with their best players, because they've been out so often. Now, the one thing is they've kept him on the bench. It's not like they've started him because of some of the injuries. They've let him be the reserve that they intended him to be when they traded for him. Unfortunately for Bogdanović, the efficiency is very unlike him. He's shooting 44% on twos, 34% on threes. You can see the value, obviously, in his like sheer ability to create something for himself and for others, especially as part of a reserve unit that after all the trades and with all the injuries, so with a lot of their reserves moving into the starting lineup, the reserve units that Bojan has been forced to carry a lot of nights have just, quite frankly, been really low on rotation caliber talent. Like, when the Knicks aren't at full strength, and that's probably dragging down his efficiency, or almost certainly is. There's not a lot of talent around him in a lot of these lineups. I still think you would have liked to see a little more from him. But again, I think the hope was at the time, and come is...
on, you definitely would have liked to have seen more out of him.
I know, but I'm saying the hope at the time was, and I guess the hope still is, especially based on the way he was playing in Detroit to start the season. It's not like, you know, he had completely fallen off a cliff this season and then this was to be expected. Like, he was still pretty efficient as a Piston with way less talent around. Well, I guess maybe not way less given the injuries, but you get what I'm saying. So the hope still has to be, and what the Knicks, I'm sure, are convincing themselves of, is if we can get healthy, big if, but if we can get healthy, and if that reserve unit is, you know, more of Josh Hart and Precious Achiuwa with Bojan and Burks, as opposed to some of the lineups they've had to trot out there off the bench, that he'll look like the Bojan Bogdanović they traded for. I'm not convinced that that's going to be the case. I'm just saying, what else is there to do if you're the Knicks but hope that that is the case? Because it's been pretty rough. And obviously, if he's not lifting the reserve unit's offensive floor and being as efficient as he's been known to be in his career, if he's not doing that, it's a real eyesore for this team, because defensively, you know, the guy leaves a lot to be desired. So, disappointing start to his Knicks tenure for Bojan Bogdanović. Not sure how much of it I put, you know, just at his feet, and how much of it I put at, like, you know, look at the quote-unquote talent he's had around him in some of these reserve units with all these injuries.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem like a great sign that he is, like, not cracking 20 minutes a game.
Yeah.
In pretty much any of these games, even without OG or Randall healthy.
But again,
like, that doesn't bode well for his ability to factor into the mix when those guys get back. And but, I understand what you're saying, to the point of, like, yeah, playing off of more talented players will make him more effective. But your point about his defense leaving a lot to be desired is the reason that, obviously, he, whether you want to say he's in Tom Thibodeau's doghouse, or he's clearly not in the circle of trust for Tom Tib.
He ain't in the penthouse, that's for sure.
So, like, I just don't know. And I mean, I wouldn't say I was down on the trade. Like, I thought it was a good trade for them, but much like with the Rozier trade, I feel vindicated in kind of pouring cold water on some of the excitement about this, because I just didn't think, like, I thought he could help them for sure, but I also was, you know, whether it was concerned or at least curious about how much he actually could help them given the defensive limitations and the fact that, while he is a helpful offensive player, I just didn't know how that would fit into what they actually needed, I guess. I think Burks actually fits into what they need more than Bogdanović does, and Burks has been not very good as a Knick either. But if I had to pick one of those guys where I'm like, you know, in a playoff game, it's more likely that this guy's going to be in the rotation or be factoring in down the stretch, I kind of think it's going to be Burks rather than Bogdanović, because he brings that ball handling element that they need off of the bench. But even then, like, you know, the come up of Deuce McBride has maybe made Burks less essential than he seemed when they acquired him. So I just think that come playoff time might wind up looking like sort of a nothing trade.
Yeah.
But even if there's just one game where, like, Bogey comes off the bench and hits five threes, then that could, you know, justify that trade right there.
Yeah, and to that point, even as disappointing as he's been, there have been a couple games. Like, there was one game he had a team-high 22 points in a win over the Sixers, then he had 20 points in an upset win over the Cavs, where it's like, yeah, he's been disappointing on the whole, But just like you're saying, if there's like one playoff game where his shooting or whatever it is helps them get over the hump, he has had a couple games where he's very much been a big part of the reason they've won while undermanned. And, you know, with how tight things are in the East and jockeying for playoff positions, like, you know, those wins will matter. So if you're looking for like the smallest shred of a silver lining, it's like, all right, he has had a couple games where he gave them something off the bench from a scoring perspective that they wouldn't have had they not made that trade. Whether you think that matters or not in those couple wins, or whether you think that at all overrides the deficiencies that have come with him,
it's another matter.
Doesn't seem to know what he should be doing, even like within the flow of their offense. He looks like tentative and just unsure of himself. Like, I think it's been a weird transition for him going from, you know, obviously a not very competitive environment in Detroit to a place where he's in a different spot in the pecking order. And like, I think he's struggled to kind of figure out what his niche is actually supposed to be. Like, I find him drifting a lot of the time, and then like he'll miss a couple of threes and completely lose confidence. It's just, it's looked kind of rough all around. But on the positive side of things, and I know I'm, you know, for a lot of people, I'm not going to be breaking news here because OG's plus minus was like the story in the sport for a while, but I do still think that it's worth pointing out. Since the trade, OG has played in, I want to say, half the Knicks games. Like, he's played in 17 games.
Yeah, they're 15-2.
17 games since then. And despite, again, missing basically half the Knicks games since the trade, he is third in the NBA in raw plus minus in those 17 games. Like, since the trade. So it's like Tatum is number one at plus 342. That's in 35 games. Jalen Brunson is number two. He is plus 301. That's in 32 games. OG Anunoby is plus 297 in 17 games. Yeah. They demolished teams with him on the floor. And I loved the fit for him at the time. It's been even better than I could have imagined. It's been seamless offensively with, like you mentioned, his ability to spot up and hit threes, but also make really timely cuts. And then the defense, which had slipped in his last few weeks in Toronto. After like a defensive player of the year caliber start to the season, he had really let go of the rope at that end of the floor. And God, has he been exceptional defensively as a Knick, just taking on any assignment asked of him, guards, bigs, whatever it is, on the ball, off the ball. Absolutely spectacular. And shout out to Precious Achiuwa too, like a kind of forgotten, you know, if you want to call him a throw-in in the trade, it doesn't feel that way anymore because he has been leaned on very heavily during this stretch and has acquitted himself really well, again, especially at the defensive end.
Yeah, with Robinson and then for a time, Hartenstein out as well. Achiuwa came up big for them. And then, yeah, just with respect to OG, like we mentioned the 15-2 record, you mentioned the plus-minus. He missed those 18 games. Obviously, the Knicks struggled. He came back for three games with Randall still out. Obviously, with Robinson still out. Like, the team's still not nearly at full strength. And they win those three games immediately when OG comes back in the lineup. Again, now he's missed a couple in a row. So, yeah, his value to this team, like, you know, for all we talked about Boyan and Burks a little bit, and even Precious, like, if the Knicks get their start, like, if Randall's back, maybe Robinson's back, like, the other key guy from all the guys they trade for is obviously OG. Like, if OG can be healthy with those other guys back, even if Boyan's disappointing and Burks is out of the rotation, whatever, they've got a shot to do something because of how well and how perfectly he fits on both ends.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's probably a perfect segue before we break to talk the Raptors' new guys, since we spoke Siakam in Indiana and OG in New York. Now, obviously, a bit of a different tone to this conversation because while the Pacers and Knicks are playing for something in the short term, the Raptors are clearly looking towards next year, you know, the offseason and then next season. They have been probably the league's worst team over almost the last month. They've lost eight in a row. Their plus minus is terrible during that time. But anyone who's been paying attention, Barnes is out. RJ Barrett, obviously away after the tragic loss of his younger brother, quickly has now missed it'll be a second straight game tonight due to personal reasons. Then you've got Jakob Poeltl, who's obviously very important to what this team does. I believe he dislocated a finger like a game or two after Barnes broke his hand. So the Raptors were already a young slash bad team, and then they lost all these guys. We talked off air about how the lineup that they've been left with is almost surely the worst roster in the league. If you look at the lineup they fielded, or I guess courted, against Sacramento the other night, that was like half a G League roster. If that team plays 82 games, they maybe win five. Like, it's rough. So anyway, very long way of saying, this is quite a different conversation than talking Knicks and Pacers, but we can talk about what we saw from Emmanuel Quickley and RJ Barrett, and even, you know, how they interacted with Scottie Barnes and all that stuff. And let's do that now.
Yeah.
I feel like
the Raptors currently have nobody in their starting lineup who began the year
right
in their starting five.
Yeah.
Nor do they have either of the guys that they got in the OG Anunoby trade playing right now. It's just, it's a hot mess.
Yeah.
So I
was going to say, wins and losses aside, I do feel when it comes to Quickley and Barrett that there had been some positive returns and some reason for optimism heading into next season. So let's talk about it. Where do you want to start?
Absolutely.
IQ or RJ?
Let's start with RJ, because I think, at least to me, that's been the bigger surprise, like how well he played after the trade. And just to put some numbers on it, like, we had talked a few times about how, like, we always saw promise in RJ, but he had never had anything resembling an efficient scoring season. And as you like to point out, he had never had a season in which he even approached average from any shooting zone on the floor. At the rim, floater range, mid-range, three-point range, although he did actually have the one season where he shot 40% from three. Yeah. So his effective field goal percentage with the Knicks this season was 47.8%. Effective field goal percentage, for those who don't know, it's just like a field goal percentage that adjusts for the number, like what you shoot on three-pointers.
Yeah, the extra value of threes.
So that excludes free throws, which is important because RJ has not shot free throws well as a Raptor for some reason.
59%. But
47.8% with the Knicks, and he had maxed out, like, his best ever. It was in 2020-2021, the year that he had that great three-point shooting season, and he maxed out that year at 49.9% effective field goal percentage. In 27 games with the Raptors, it was at 60.6%, and that was helped by him shooting 42% from three, which is the aspect of his sudden improvement that feels least sustainable, considering he was a sub 35% career three-point shooter before that. But I think what has really fueled his rise, and that feels like it might be somewhat sustainable, is how much better he's been at finishing at the rim. Going from 57% with the Knicks, that was 17th percentile among forwards, to 71% with the Raptors, which is 84th percentile. Just a huge bump. That, I mean, you can, I guess, give me your thoughts on what you think enabled that to happen. I think there are a lot of credible theories that I've heard. Like, one that I know our pal Samson Folk has posited is just that going from a team with a bunch of other lefties in the starting lineup around him to one where he is the only lefty has had an interesting effect, where it's like actually screws up the defense because they're not primed for that in the way that they are when they're scouting the Knicks. And like, they can shade everybody to their right hand. You know, it's like a more natural defensive coverage when you're doing it for multiple players than when you kind of have the changeup of being the only lefty on the floor. You're operating from a side of the floor where there aren't going to be a bunch of other players like kind of scrabbling to occupy that space as well. So I think that makes sense. I think the pace that the Raptors play with, not that the Knicks don't, but like, their starters have always been kind of plodding compared to their bench. The pace the Raptors played with, I think, has benefited him because he's gotten a lot of his stuff in transition and semi-transition, and just their offensive flow in general. Like, their offense is completely different to the Knicks in terms of how the ball moves and the players move. And I think that's allowed RJ to get more of his stuff kind of in motion you know, coming off of curls and making stampede cuts and things like that, where he's able to get a little bit more of a head of steam going downhill rather than trying to initiate from a standstill, which he's never been especially good at. I think all of that has helped, and it has produced a much, much more efficient offensive player. So that's all been super encouraging, and possibly will have some staying power for him. I also think, as a playmaker, this is like the best playmaking that I've seen from him, too. Just like really sound decision making, quality passing on the move. To throw out the surface level stats: 20.8 points, 6.2 rebounds, 4 assists, and only 2.2 turnovers. 60% from 2, 42% from 3, and then, as we said, 59% from the free throw line. But because he's been so efficient from those other zones, even the free throw shooting leaves him with 62% true shooting as a Raptor, which is just eons ahead of where he's been in any other season of his career.
And you mentioned the 4 dimes. Has never averaged more than 3 assists per game in a season before. For as impressive and pleasantly surprising as the efficiency has been, I think what I've been most impressed by and pleasantly surprised by is the playmaking. Because as we've discussed before, inefficient volume scorer who was prone to forcing things, but he was also prone to tunnel vision a lot in New York. And now, it's not just the assists. It's like some of the passes he's making, forget about whether they're assists or not, and the vision he's displayed that, quite frankly, I didn't think he had, because it was rarely on display in New York. Like, some of the passes he's made, some of the holes he's thread passes through or seen that I didn't think he could have seen, like, have been really impressive and really encouraging for the Raptors going forward and for his future. Like, recently, in the last game he played, he was essentially a point guard. The Raptors essentially started him as like a quasi-point guard in that game in Denver, where the depleted Raptors had no business being in a game against the defending champion Nuggets. They were in the game. They ended up losing by 6. RJ has 9 assists, a career high 9 assists in that game. Just like the in-season development, just even as a Raptor in his 27 games as a Raptor, has been really encouraging. And I think in terms of scoring the ball, obviously, the percentages are great. And, you know, seeing him shoot it like this is great and finish like this is great. But I think what I've really liked is how he's gotten it all, for the most part, within the flow of the Raptors offense. Because again, in New York, a big part of the reason I didn't like his offensive game is because it often felt forced. It often felt like that kind of, like I said, you know, the typical inefficient volume scorer where it's like, okay, I haven't had a drive in a while, or I haven't got mine in a while, so now I just got to like force something. And he's been the exact opposite of that as a Raptor. It's been a lot of catch and shoot stuff. It's been a lot of like great decisions in terms of driving and like when a lane opens up. And
just
when,
quick decisions. Exactly. Too. Like, that's the most important thing.
Yes, and making the right pass. Like I said, making some passes that a lot of players don't even see. And RJ in New York, I don't think would have seen, or didn't seem like he would have seen. So just all around as an offensive player, he looks like a completely new guy in Toronto. I don't know how sustainable that is, but like, again, I think I'm more encouraged by the signs that are there as opposed to just like, well, he's shooting the ball better. Or if he was playing the same style where a lot of stuff seemed forced and it was just going in more, I wouldn't be as encouraged. But I think the way he's gone about it within the flow of the offense and the playmaking and the vision really encouraged me to the point where it's like, you know, do I think he's going to be a 20 point per game on 62% true shooting guy? Maybe not. But can he be a solid secondary scorer in the NBA with some playmaking chops, with good size? Like, that's a really good player and one that the Raptors should be excited now to have in their future.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about defense with RJ or with Quickley or with the Raptors in general. Let's just leave that aside. We'll focus on the offensive growth, and we can save the defense for another day because it's been real messy.
Yeah.
But I think you've seen all that you could have possibly hoped to see out of RJ, especially considering, and I will cop to this, man, I treated him like a throw-in in that deal.
So did I.
I was like, you know, I think he was more about just like salary filler than he was about a guy like being a guy that the Raptors actually wanted and targeted in this deal. You know, Masai Ujiri came out and pretty forcefully like denied that line of thinking, said this was a guy they really wanted. And you know, GMs are going to say things like you can believe them or not believe them, but I think whatever they saw in him is something that has very much been borne out since he's become a Raptor. And I think he's played pretty much the best basketball of his career, even though it hasn't felt all the way consequential. I think it is consequential if you're thinking about the big picture
100%.
For this team and where he might fit into that. But the defense has to get better.
Yeah, no question. With respect to Quickly, I think the first stretch of his Raptors career might have been slightly disappointing from a numbers perspective. You know, he weirdly lost the ability to finish inside. That floater game really fell apart. But by and large, I think the offensive side has been a positive for him, and especially post All-Star break. When, whether it was, I don't know, the time off, maybe the time to get more acclimated with the playbook, I don't know. But he came out of the All-Star break, I think, a much different player, a much better offensive player. And then even when Barnes went down and Quickly had to shoulder more of the offense, he made the most of it. Like, he didn't look any worse for wear since the All-Star break, averaging 20.3 points, 8 assists, 5.8 rebounds, 1.2 steals, also shooting 38.5% from deep on 8 three-point attempts per game. Again, I mentioned he just has to figure out what's going on with that floater and with his finishing inside. But we talked about it at the time of the trade. I think you didn't quite see it in terms of the partnership with Barnes. But in theory, the combination of speed, movement shooting, creation ability, playmaking, I still think it is going to be a great complement to Barnes going forward, because I don't really understand how it won't be, even though it hasn't, you know, borne out that way so far this season. I think
these 1-4 fits are tricky, Cash. I'm telling
exactly.
You.
Exactly. I think I mentioned it to you one night at the arena shortly after Quickly debuted as a Raptor, but I was like, someone find me odds on Emmanuel Quickly for most improved player in 2025, because I'm not saying I would pick him to win it, but if the odds are juicy enough, I think that's one I would sprinkle some action on, because I do believe in what we've seen since the All-Star break and in general, just in his game and how it could fit beside Barnes in Darko Rajakovic's system. If he's, you know, more willing to let it fly when he should and when he's open, I think from like a numbers increase perspective, he could just be a classic most improved guy next year. So something to watch there. But on a team perspective, look, for as bad as things look right now, you go into next season with Barnes, Quickly, Barrett, you know, an improved Grady Dick, who has obviously had a very up-and-down rookie year, but I still think that combination of size and shooting and what we've seen from him the last month or so has been really encouraging. You go in to next season with that core who's had a full training camp and year-plus together. If you can just get some quality depth this offseason, I think this is a team that can bounce back quickly. Pardon the pun.
Yeah, we'll see. I think like the offseason is going to tell us a lot about what kind of priority they place on next season.
Fair.
And I think that might depend on whether they wind up conveying their pick this year or not. If they don't, then I think we might see them take a bit of a longer view and actually try to punt next season ahead of what's projected to be a much stronger draft than this year. If they know their pick next year is out the door, if it lands in the top six, then maybe that compels them to try and be a little bit more competitive in the near term. But they have a lot of options in terms of like the cap space that they could have to play with, or they have the option to operate as an over-the-cap team. You know, we'll see what happens with the draft. But, like, yeah, I think it's we're going to learn a lot about the direction they see this going over the next few months. But to all the stuff about Quickly, I've mostly come away encouraged. I think what you're looking for when you're watching him with this team is, are you seeing the signs that this is a guy who's going to be a lead guard moving forward? Having a guy like Scotty Barnes who can operate as a point forward makes some of the skills required to do that a little bit less important, but ultimately it's still going to be the guy who's going to have the ball in his hands more than anybody else on the team if he is going to be that guy for your team. So I think to that point, there have been a lot of encouraging signs, the playmaking especially, just like the like basic stuff like pick and roll, pocket passing, you know, with either hand, with a live dribble, all that stuff I think has gotten a lot better since he first arrived and since he's like started getting more reps as a lead ball handler. To me, the synergy with Poeltl developed very quickly and looked really strong before Poeltl got hurt. It just wasn't there with Scotty. They couldn't figure out their timing. Scotty's screens weren't hitting. And IQ, despite being a very quick and shifty guard, I don't think his handle is good enough for him to just like routinely beat his guy off of the bounce. Like, we have not seen a lot of that from him. In the half court, his handle doesn't really get him to a lot of places. He needs a good screen, right? Like, in order to get into the teeth of the defense and to create. So I think that's a big reason why it didn't really click with Scotty. He wasn't getting those solid screens like the ones he was getting from Poeltl. And it was also just a pacing problem. Like, neither of them seemed to know what they were trying to do when they interacted in an action. And it would often wind up like with a almost perfunctory screen. And then they would both kind of stand around, like one of them, whichever one of them had the ball, would like just be dribbling in place, kick it to the other guy. They might try a rescreen, but that wouldn't get them anywhere either. It just, their actions together went nowhere. And so it's a shame that, you know, Scotty's probably done for the season. I don't know when we'll see Quickly again, but the thing that I was going to be watching for, like the biggest reason to me to watch Raptors games at the tail end of this lost season would have been to see whether those guys could build that chemistry. And now we won't really get to see that, but maybe an off season together will help get them on the same page. But it wasn't there at all. Like, there were very few signs even that they were, you know, figuring out whether it was the floor balance or the pacing and screening actions, anything like that. It just didn't happen. But Quickly himself, I mean, the shooting is just the biggest thing. And especially if you look at him and RJ together and what the Raptors got in that package, the two things offensively that I think they needed most: movement shooting, dribble drive, rim pressure. And they get the former from Quickly and they get the latter from Barrett. And that is huge for them. So with Quickly, you mentioned 38.5% from three on 8 attempts per game. And just like the variety of ways that he can get them is the biggest thing for the Raptors, right? The fact that he can do it off of movement puts so many different plays on the menu that weren't there before. Even something as simple as like a rip DHO, right? The play that we talk about with the Nuggets all the time, of like the guard, in their case Murray, setting the back screen for the wing to cut back door from the elbow and then flying up and taking that gut DHO. Something the Raptors couldn't really run before. They just didn't have like the movement shooting, the quick trigger shooting in order to run that with any of their guards. Now they can do that with Quickly. They can do it out of flex action as well, where he's setting the flex screen and he's coming up for the DHO out of that. Like, they just, and like Grady Dick in the second half has brought some of that as well, but it just changes the look of their team so much. And I think at the time that we had written that piece, it's probably changed by now because of who the Raptors have been playing. But they had gone from being 27th in three-point percentage before the trade to 13th afterwards. And I think they'd gone from like 11th to 6th in rim volume. So that's just showing you right there like how both Quickly and Barrett are changing the shape of their offense. So I think really encouraging signs. Like you mentioned, he's had real challenges finishing at the rim. And for whatever reason, his floater touch, which was so money in New York this year, has just evaporated in Toronto. I don't have a good explanation for that, but I also just don't think there's any reason to think that it won't come back. And I think the really encouraging thing is, like, the biggest point of frustration for me with Quickly, I think, initially, was that he was killing his dribble on a lot of drives, not finishing them, not getting all the way to the rim, either picking up his dribble or just pulling up for floaters when I thought he had a chance to, even if it wasn't to continue for a layup. Like, Nash under the basket, keep his dribble alive and see what else opened up. And I think in the last few games before this personal absence, he had really made it a point to get to the rim more. And after the All-Star break, his rim frequency was up to 21%, which is still not huge, but is like nearing average for a guard. Before that, it was 13% with the Raptors. So it was a big difference. And I think that's going to be a key for him as he looks to level up as a lead guard in the future.
Yeah, I think with him and Barrett, beside Barnes in Darko Rajakovic's system, I think there is a path, and with Grady Dick as well, I think there's a path to potentially like a pretty good offense as soon as next season. Defensively, I think, is the question mark, or it's like, if they actually do want to compete for anything of significance next season, that's probably where they're going to have to figure out how to plug some holes. But still, in terms of the two biggest pieces that they got in return for the trades they made this season, I think mostly encouraging signs going forward. Let's take the break. come back and maybe get to just a few more teams more rapid fire style. What's up, Pound the Rock listeners? Just a friendly reminder to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can also check out the Scores Fantasy Football Podcast with Justin Boone. And in case you haven't already, download the Score app, available on iPhone and Android. That's where you can find all of our feature content, as well as live scores, updates, and breaking news. And don't forget to check out the Score's YouTube page for an informative yet lighthearted dive into the sports world's trending topics. Now back to the show. All right, Wolfon, still a few more teams and players to get to. We're going to get to them a lot quicker than we did the first chunk. So give me a name. Who do you want to start off with?
Royce O'Neal.
All right.
Thought it was one of the best, maybe the best kind of like budget under the radar deadline addition. I loved his fit in Phoenix. I loved how he gave them functional depth, whereas as we talked about before, they had a lot of fake depth before that. And I just think he's been great. Like, as much as on the last episode, and I still 100% feel this way, I'm just like down on the Suns in general. Took them off my list of like actual title contenders, no longer believe they're worthy of that designation. I do think O'Neal is like a very sensible fit there and makes them better now, and especially should make them like a more formidable playoff team. They were just so starved for like functional size on the wing, functional depth on the wing. And I think he's done everything that you would want to see from him there. He's shooting over 39% from three. And the other thing with his offense that like it doesn't get enough credit, people do point this out, but just for me, watching him there, like his extra passing has been so valuable, just like keeping the gears moving for an offense that can get very stagnant. And he's got 57 assists to 13 turnovers as a Sun, like a better than 4-1 assist to turnover ratio with like not an insignificant number of assists. And I think that even kind of undersells it, because a lot of those extra passes don't lead directly to baskets, but they just give the Suns offense a little bit more liquidity and keep things flowing when they otherwise might dry up. So you couple that with the fact that he has been a huge addition for their defense. They have a 107.8 defensive rating with him on the court, which is better than the Timberwolves league best mark. And there's a couple things with that. Like, one is, so he can fit really well with lineups that feature Nurkic in them.
Yep.
And he can either like guard top wings in those alignments, but like if you want to do something like you're playing the Thunder and you want to stash Nurkic on Josh Giddey, you can put Royce O'Neal on an opposing center. Not every opposing center, but like a lot of opposing centers he can work in that matchup, and he's very switchable and he can hold his own against bigger guys. So that's one way. But then even, or almost especially actually, in the smaller lineups without Nurk on the floor, with KD at the five, he's made those so much better by being able to fill out the wing in those lineups with a guy who actually has that functional size. And as an illustration of that, Durant at center lineups before the trade outscored by 14.2 points per 100 possessions. With O'Neal in them, Durant at center lineups have outscored opponents by 7.9 points per 100 possessions. So he's really changed the look and feel of those lineups especially. And I just think if you're looking ahead to the playoffs, you can't overstate the value of adding a versatile 3-and-D guy on the wing. And I, you know, for what they paid to get him, I think it's been a wonderful addition.
Yep, and you can't underestimate just adding a playoff rotation caliber talent, like straight up. We've talked about how they had a lot of fake depth. I think they've got more real depth now. The playoffs are very much like a 6-8 player time of the year. And now you think about it, obviously you'd be banking on health that hasn't always been there for this team and that I'm not convinced will be there. But I'm just saying, in a perfect world where they were healthy, now you can all of a sudden look at a team where it's like, with the big three, Nurk, Grayson Allen, Royce O'Neal, Eric Gordon, like all of a sudden, you're like, that's like actually a pretty solid 7-man playoff rotation. And it's crazy how sometimes even one player and like role player like Royce O'Neal can change the way you see a team or really like complete a picture like that. But in this case, it did, because they needed another legitimate rotation guy who you can trust in the playoffs, and you're fine throwing him out there. Royce O'Neal's that guy. Home run for the Suns, and one that I think has played out like that so far, too.
Definitely.
All right, real quickly, because I know this is a guy you wanted to talk about. I don't think we ended up including him in the piece, or maybe we did and I forgot. But again, kind of similar to the Raptors, where it's like not talking about stakes this year. But Simone Fontecchio, the Paizan,
yes,
has been really good for the Pistons and has really helped them look more like an NBA team a lot of nights, quite frankly, in terms of like their offensive functionality. We talked at the time about how like we didn't love the deal from Utah's perspective, because Fontecchio, with his shooting and what he brought to Utah's starting lineup, was really important for them. And like, you know, he's an RFA this year, not old by any stretch. Like, he could still be a really good piece for any team going forward. And I think it was a smart move by the Pistons to pick him up. I think he's really good for Cade and the young guys who needed more shooting talent and spacing around them, and just kind of veteran know-how for where the Pistons were. And, you know, for as bright spots as there have been this season, I actually think finding Simone Fontecchio and adding him to their future, probably, if they can retain him in the offseason, which I think they'll plan to do, has been a sneaky good move.
I loved it at the time, and he's been awesome. So I gotta say, honestly, and I feel like I can say this because I will cop to my bad takes, which there are many of over the years, but like, I think that my takes about like trade season this year have all been really strong. Like, they've all borne out in pretty much the way that I expected them to. Some like to more like greater extremes, I guess, than I would have expected. But man, I liked the Fontecchio addition for Detroit, even though they gave up a valuable second round pick, like what I think could be the 31st pick in the draft. And I think people were sort of scratching their heads, like, why would a team in the Pistons position give up a pick like that to add like a role player? But I thought, like, he's going to be an RFA. They're going to be able to retain him. And he is just the exact kind of low maintenance, eminently useful, gap filling role players that is going to help their young guys without taking anything off the table. And I think that's exactly how it's played out. He's fit there like a glove. He's making life easier for everybody around him, making a big impact while barely touching the ball, you know, defending well. The Pistons are way, way better with him on the floor, averaging 15.4 points on 54% shooting from two, 43% from three, 85% from the line. It's like, what more could you ask for? You know, it's just a smart guy who knows how to move without the ball, and it's just going to make things easier for Cade and Ivy and Durin and everybody else that they need to develop over the next few years. I think they should make every effort to retain him. He's been a perfect fit.
Yeah, for a Pistons team that over the last maybe month and a half has quietly been close to competent. And you might laugh when Roy Rise and be like, is that really what we're celebrating now? But given where they were coming from, yes, them looking even close to competent or respectable for like a month and a half is a really encouraging sign. Baby steps, people. And adding Simone Fontecchio, big part of those baby steps.
Yeah. Quentin Grimes, on the other hand, who, you know, if we're talking about, I guess, bad takes on my part, because I liked them acquiring him, and that may still work out. I don't think, you know, it's not like they're going to miss Bogdanovich or Burks all that much. And while they could have gotten more for Bogdanovich if they traded him earlier, I thought getting Grimes was a nice piece of business in a vacuum. And he just cannot make a shot there. He's shooting 36% from two and 14% from three. That's 4 for 28 from three as a Piston. So, you know, I think his defense has been pretty solid, but if he's not making shots, then I don't know how much he's actually going to be able to help them.
All right. The Buddy Hield, Kyle Lowry combo or Pat Bev in Milwaukee? Where do you want to go here?
Let's do Hield and Lowry.
All right. Give me your thoughts. I'll give you mine.
It's so hard to have any cogent thoughts about the 76ers, just given all the injuries they've dealt with. And like, it's just a completely different team now than what it will look like or would look like if they were whole.
Well, I mentioned this to you when we wrote the New Faces, New Places. And I was like, I feel like half of, or like 75% of my blurbs were explaining why we can't read too much into these players' performances with their new teams because they're not playing with the teams they were supposed to play with because of all the injuries that have hit the Knicks, the Sixers,
the Raptors.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess it's hard to say in that sense. Like I like the way that Hield has sort of played off of Maxey and some other guys in the Sixers rotation, but like what I'm really curious to see is how he's able to play off of Embiid and how that two-man game can develop. I do think it was like he was starting initially and like now they're bringing him off the bench. And I, you know, he had like a bigger role in their offense early on and like they were missing more guys when he got there. So that's
took on a bit more of a playmaking responsibility too than he ever has in his career.
Yeah, very much so. So it's nice to know that like he kind of has that in his bag and maybe he becomes kind of like the captain of the bench unit in that way where they can trust him to run some pick and roll. And treat him, I don't know if they're going to treat him like their backup point guard necessarily, but like the fact that he showed those playmaking chops, I think will maybe allow them, like if Lowry, for whatever reason, just isn't playable in high leverage or just in any playoff game because his offense has just fallen off that hard, which I don't think, like based on what we've seen from him, I don't think is going to be the case. But to know that you can use Hield maybe in more of that playmaking role gives them a nice option. But, you know, yeah, I don't... Buddy Hield has been Buddy Hield. Like, he has been very good at what he does. And what I'm looking forward to seeing is how that meshes with Embiid, if or when Embiid can get back. On the Lowry front, I think this has just shown that he still has some juice left in the tank, man.
Yes.
Like, he's still out there doing Kyle Lowry things on the regular, like diving for loose balls, drawing charges, making really smart plays with the basketball, hitting threes, like grifting for fouls, picking that low-hanging fruit, like throwing hit-ahead passes to get the Sixers out and running. Like, I think he's given them exactly what they have needed from him.
Absolutely. Like, you know, as I said in the piece, it's like, well, speaking of guys being asked to fill a larger role than ideally suited for because of injuries around them, how about soon-to-be 38-year-old Kyle Lowry? Lowry turns 38 on Monday, by the way. You mentioned the possibility that he could be unplayable based on the way his offense has fallen off. I don't think either one of us expects that'll be the case. But the interesting thing with, like, his offense falling off is even if you look at, like, just in his short time with his hometown Sixers, you know, he's a 48-37-92 shooting split. So, like, when he lets it fly and when he, you know, very much at this point of his career, he picks his spots, the efficiency is still there. The issue is that he rarely shoots. Like, among 222 players who've logged at least 1,000 minutes this season, his 13% usage rate ranks 207th, which is almost unfathomable for a guard.
By the way, that's like higher than it's been all season, though. Because
I know
it was in the single digits for a while.
But even at 13%, 207th out of 222 guys that have played that many minutes, again, almost unfathomable for a guard. All the other guys in that range are like low usage big men. So if there's something that's going to make his offense, I guess, unplayable, it would just be his aversion to getting involved other than being a table setter. But he's still good at being that table setter. And he still takes good care of the ball. And like I said, when he decides to let it fly, it's usually, you know, good results. Still an exceptionally smart player who can at least get by with his smarts on the defensive end. Not quite, obviously, the point of attack defender he once was or general guard defender he once was, but I still think the smarts and the, like, strength are enough where he can get by. He's an, like, good enough caretaker on the offensive end. Again, in the right setting where he's not being counted on to play the fourth most minutes on the team, which is what he's done since they acquired him, I think it's going to be a really good fit. And I think, given the injuries they've had and given the fact he's had to be the guy who's played the fourth most minutes for them, I think he's handled himself quite well, all things considered.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I agree. I don't actually expect, like, I think he'll be playing in important games for the Sixers. I don't know how big of a role he'll have, but I think his steady hand is something that they can use. Like, they've had major turnover issues in big playoff games in the past. And I think just having somebody out there who's going to make good decisions, who you can rely on to make good decisions in high leverage spots, who you know Nick Nurse is going to trust to, whether it's execute a defensive coverage or an offensive set. Like, I think he'll be helpful for them when it really matters. So I it's nice to see that he still has some fire in the belly and some juice left in the tank, because it's this is the twilight, obviously, and I don't know how much more Kyle Lowry we are going to get to watch, but I don't have to tell our Toronto-based listeners this, but I think we should savor it.
Yeah. All right. Last one. Pat Bev in Milwaukee.
Good. Like, pretty good, man. Yeah. He has genuinely helped shore up their point of attack defense. And I think,
as expected,
people like to treat Pat Bev as just sort of a sideshow and kind of like a clown because, and like, you know, he brings that on himself sometimes with some of the things he says and does, but I don't think that that should overshadow the fact that he is a genuinely helpful basketball player who has, you know, not to the extent that the Bucks actually needed to address it, but in terms of what they could actually offer and what they could realistically get, is probably about as well as they could have done in terms of addressing that clear roster flaw and improving the point of attack defense, just getting some more toughness, more resistance, and I don't know, just a bit of ferocity, man. Like, yep. make opponents feel you, even if it's just a dude like getting under your skin, which again, I think Beverly does more than just that. But I also think that aspect can actually help for a team that has been, frankly, very low resistance in a lot of these games when defending on the perimeter. So I think in that sense, he's been a big help. I think the numbers pretty much bear that out in terms of how much better they've been defensively with him on the floor. And I think, yeah, like from that perspective, what more could you have hoped to get?
Dude, in 161 minutes with Damian Lillard and Patrick Beverley on the floor together, the Bucks have a 108.7 defensive rating, which would be in line with the number two defense in the league this season. Now, again, I understand all the caveats about small sample size and whatever, but still, given where this team was coming from when it comes to point of attack defense, and given obviously how much Damian Lillard has played into that problem, the fact that just having Pat Bev beside him, them being not just functional defensively, but actually good, that is a very, very encouraging sign for this team going forward into the playoffs, where, as both of us have been in agreement about, like, if Malik Beasley is not shooting the cover off the ball, he may very well find himself slowly out of the rotation come the postseason because of how poor, inattentive, etc. he is on the defensive end. So Pat Bev looking as good as he has beside Dame on the defensive end is all you could have asked for if you're the Bucks, and all you could have wanted out of Pat Bev. And then, like, you know, on the offensive end, a guy that very much knows his job and knows his role and plays within that role brings some nastiness to the team that I think they needed, whether you think it makes him a clown or a sideshow or not. I think he's legitimately become an underrated basketball player, you know? So yeah, I think the Bucks should be very happy with what Pat Bev's brought them. And the only thing I'll say is I think Doc Rivers actually needs to experiment more with playing Beverly with his best players more often, because that's one thing I don't think they've done enough of. Pat Bev has taken his lumps as part of very reserve-heavy lineups. I think as we move toward the playoffs, I'd like to see him get more minutes with their best players. And also, I'd like to see him be utilized more in specialized situations. And like, the example that comes to mind, and I added it in the piece, was the game Milwaukee lost to the Lakers, to the Bronless Lakers, on a D'Angelo Russell game winner, final defensive possession of the game. For some reason, Pat Beverly was on the bench and Dame was on the court, and like, has nothing to do with even Dame's stature as like, you know, a legend in the game and a star, because there are plenty of teams who, even for a franchise level star, if they're a defensive liability, we'll have them off the court in a situation like that. Few seconds left, very much a defensive possession to potentially save the game for you. I think there are times like that where Doc can actually use Pat more in those specialized roles. And like I said, I think he can get him in there with their best players more often. And I hope for the Bucks' sake that they do that once the playoffs start, because I think they'll be a better team for it and something closer to a contender than they are right now.
Word. Should we leave it there? Like, we're over 80 minutes, and
I think we can.
Is our guy Brent? Is his name Brent? The Lakers fan who wrote in. Is he going to be cheese that we didn't talk about Spencer Dinwiddie?
Maybe, but I don't know. Has Spencer Dinwiddie moved you?
He hasn't, but I will say, okay, so he's got like 49% true shooting and a 10% usage rate with the Lakers so far. So he's making Kyle Lowry look like Luka Doncic, okay? And yet, he has like by far the best on-off splits on the team since he got there. Like, they're killing it with him on the floor. And I gotta be honest, I have not seen anything from watching him that explains that to me, that like gives me a real good rationale for why they're so good with him on court. But I mean, kudos to him and good job Lakers for picking him off the scrap heap. And I guess he's helping somehow. I don't think he's been bad. He just is like not super involved. And I don't really know why they're winning his minutes so dramatically, but good stuff, I guess.
Well, there you go, Brent. There's your Lakers talk for the week. All right. I think we've exhausted our time here today, as usual. Do you have a fan shout out for us this week?
I do. It's kind of like a repeat fan shout out, but I just wanted to shout out Jing, who had commented on Spotify before. She was the one who wrote in asking for timestamps.
My bad, Jing. Still haven't got to those.
Yeah, we still haven't done that. Maybe, I don't know, this would be a good episode maybe to... Oh, sorry. Cash is editing today and he's not happy. All right. We're not going to do it for this episode.
Maybe we'll see.
But she commented on Apple Podcasts just to tell us a little bit more. And she said, just wanted to say thanks for the shout out on this last episode. Tried to find a way to email you guys, but didn't know how. Anyway, really appreciate y'all and all your work. My request for timestamps was not meant to be a criticism, but mostly just for my scatterbrained mind to listen to things out of order when I want to. Again, thanks to both of you guys. I'm listening to your show from Toronto. So thank you, Jing. And I am sorry again that we haven't done the timestamps, which, to be fair, we didn't exactly say that we were going to do, but we promised we would try. And I'll make that promise again. We will try.
To piggyback on Jing's comment or her feedback, when she mentioned how she wanted to email us, but didn't know how, perfect segue to our call out to our fans. Like I said, we've shouted out hundreds of fans and listeners over the last couple of years, but the analytics tell us there are thousands of you out there who have never received a well-deserved shout out before. So hit us up. If you want to email us like Jing wanted to do, but just couldn't find out how, email joe.wolfond@thescore.com or joseph.cacharo@thescore.com. Find me on Instagram at joe__cash, or maybe the easiest way, find either of us on Twitter at josephcacharo or at joey_YOU, and let us know where you're listening from, how long you've been a listener of the show, what you like, maybe what you don't like, and we will get you a well-deserved shout out on a future episode for keeping us going the way you do. Until one of those future episodes, for Joe Wolfon, I'm Joseph Cacharo. Pound the rock.